Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO FM. This morning's program is linked together by a recent novel, Kim Stanley Robinson's The Ministry for the Future. On the program, Bill Resnick will conclude his two-part interview with L. Weinrub on differing visions for our energy grid. And Jan Hocken will talk with Emmeline Friedman about the mysteries of cryptocurrencies and how they function in the world of banking and finance. Robinson's novel serves as the link connecting our response to climate change with issues of high finance. We're in the midst of KBOO's fall membership drive. As a premium for KBOO donors, the Old Mole is offering prints of Betty Lee's activist photography. 10 lucky donors will be chosen at random, with every donor eligible. Please go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 or mail a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. You can become a monthly sustaining member, up your monthly donation by a few dollars, or make a one-time gift. All are very much appreciated. It's those donations that keep us on the air. So our thanks for whatever you're able to give. And now it's time for our regular feature, Another World is Possible. Theme music today is by LOL9. That's spelled LOL, then the German 9, maybe LOL not, in other words, irony, singing about Mother Nature. Here's LOL9. This morning, the Old Mole Repertory Theater Players present a radio drama starring Luisa Martinez as a longtime bureaucratic functionary in a government agency or NGO concerned with climate change, and me as a young, naive radio personality who thinks I know more than I actually do. The setting is a KBOO studio, maybe around the year 2035, and we're broadcasting live. It's clear that Luisa's character is disdainful, thinks that no good can come of our interview, and that I am wasting her important time. This drama is actually a chapter in an important book I want to tell you about, Kim Stanley Robinson's The Ministry for the Future. Here, then, is our drama. Today we're here to discuss potential alternatives to the global neoliberal order, which seems to be in such imminent danger of collapse. Are there any already existing alternatives we can look to?
China, obviously.
But China seems very deeply implicated in the global economy.
They have a command economy that overrules the free market to bolster Chinese interests.
That's so interesting. What could we call such a mysterious new amalgam?
Socialism.
Oh, my. How very transgressive of you, not to say nostalgic. But I seem to recall that China is always careful to add the phrase with Chinese characteristics whenever they use the word socialism. And it seems to many that those Chinese characteristics make for a completely new thing.
Yes, but no.
You don't agree?
No, it's socialism with Chinese characteristics.
These characteristics, including a huge dollop of capitalism, it seems.
Yeah.
So might we learn things from them?
No.
How come?
Because we don't like them.
Isn't that rather prejudiced of us?
They don't like us either.
So, no hope of change from that quarter. What about the poor? The 4 billion poorest people alive have less wealth than the richest 10 people on the planet. So they're not very powerful, but no one can deny that there are a lot of them. Might they force change from below?
There are guns in their faces.
What about the so-called precariat then? Those middle billions just scraping by, what Americans still call the middle class, speaking of nostalgia. Could they rise up and change things by way of some kind of mass action?
Guns in their faces too.
And yet we do sometimes see demonstrations, sometimes quite large ones.
Demonstrations are parties. People party and then go home. Nothing changes.
Well, but what about coordinated mass action? That sounds like more than partying to me. The so-called fiscal strike that we hear so much about, leading to a financial crash and the subsequent nationalization of the banks, for instance. National governments would then be back in control, coordinating a complete takeover of global finance. They could rewrite the WTO rules and create some kind of quantitative easing, giving new fiat money to Green New Deal type causes.
We call that legislation.
So again, we come back to legislatures. These are usually thought to be features of representative democracies. To the extent that such democracies still exist, if they ever did, their legislatures would have to be voted in by voting majorities by definition, 51% at the least, or more, if possible, in all major countries where such systems obtain. They would all have to join the plan.
Yeah.
So, this seems quite practical. What keeps us from doing that?
People are stupid. Also, the rich will fight it.
Again, this presumption that the rich have more power than the poor.
Yes.
But might it also be the case that there would be some kind of systemic resistance to change also, in that all these laws that need to change are intertwined and therefore can't be easily disentangled?
Yes.
You could even say that money itself would resist this change. Indeed, it seems to be the case that there's simply a kind of inherent, inbuilt resistance to change.
Constipation is a bitch. Sometimes you just have to sit on the box and push harder.
Well put. I guess you could call that the story of our decade, or the entire century for that matter.
Why stop there?
Such a trenchant image for history, I must say.
Tremendous relief when all that stuff is out of you.
No doubt. Well, that about wraps it up for this week. Perhaps it's time to pull down our pants and have a seat. I invite everyone listening to join us next week, this same time.
It might take longer.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you, my co-star, Luisa Martinez. That was a reading, maybe even a dramatic reading, of chapter 38 in Kim Stanley Robinson's 2020 novel, The Ministry for the Future. Robinson is an important author for us here at Another World is Possible, because the question of possibility underlies so much of his work. Plausible social transformation towards something good is difficult to pull off in fiction. Authors find it easier to write about a society where the big change has already occurred. The protagonist may fall asleep and wake up sometime in the utopian future, there and our curiosity, supposedly satisfied with a few lines or paragraphs about a revolution that happened while they were sleeping. Or their boat or plane or spaceship may stray off course and land them in a wonderful or better hidden society with little apparent need to explain how the society came about. Those authors aim to show that something better could exist, that another world is possible, but don't give many clues for how we might actually get there. Kim Stanley Robinson is different. His Red Mars trilogy goes into, for me, excruciating details about how a more decent society might be constructed where there was no society before. Excruciating because he's obsessed with technicalities about how to organize a transport vessel and how to produce food where it's not been done before, as well as the social, economic, and political factors that are the context for the technicalities and primarily interest me. But the point is, he's trying to give us a path forward, show us persuasively how things could happen, and also the obstacles we would face, the resistance existing power structures could be expected to pose. Robinson's book, The Years of Rice and Salt, is a counterfactual history. What the last 600 years would have looked like on a worldwide scale, if the Chinese, rather than Europeans, had colonized the Americas. This is not a utopia, not a simplistic feel-good vision. Class struggle was still a driving force in this alternative history. Empires still happened, and societies were still, in one way or another, hierarchical. But he shows significant differences and potentials. His point is that things could have been different, that the societies we get aren't somehow predetermined. His novel, Shaman, also creates alternative societies, this time going back to the Ice Age, to explore in detail how humans do and might adapt to the natural world. Robinson's novels are not big on character development, at least the ones I've read. Their strength, rather, is their insistence, their demonstration that other ways of organizing society, more humane ways of living, are possible. And sometimes that there even are steps that can be spelled out for how to get us there. Which brings me back to his latest, The Ministry for the Future, one of the most unusual novels I've read. It's heavily didactic, yet thoroughly engrossing. A big book of 106 chapters, nearly all of them short. There is a plot, but many chapters don't directly connect with it. There are riddles, short dramas like the one which Louisa and I just presented, and technical explanations, all in service to show how we might overcome the worst effects of climate change. Also to showing what we're in for as things get worse. And most important, again, it's an effort to sketch out a practical and plausible way forward. Robinson recognizes that all the problems we face are interrelated, from gender and racial inequities to climate refugees, imperialism to impoverishment, and that capitalism is at their root. His solutions range from geoengineering to currency reform. But these are more than suggestions. This is a novel, after all. Through his characters and plot, he shows how solutions could come about. Also, what resistances to those solutions are likely, and where in the society they'd be situated. This is an anti-capitalist novel, but not one that pays much attention to mass action. In Robinson's vision, change happens largely through decisions taken by elites. They may be forced to act, and popular movements may play a role, but he doesn't dwell on that role and presents it mainly as one of protest, that is, negative reactions. Positive visions for Robinson come through elite institutions, like the organization named in the book's title, the Ministry for the Future. That's a new institution to be created. Power, in his vision, still rests with existing institutions, especially financial, but, crucially, they can be transformed under the pressure of events to take righteous action. He would have the world learn also from projects already underway, from the cooperatives of Mondragon, the communist-led state of Kerala in India, the Cuban Revolution. There's vastly more to say about this rich novel. Robinson does not pretend to have solved all social problems, but he's shown one concrete, plausible path forward and demonstrated once again that another world is possible. This has been Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO.
You make me flood my basement. Sometimes I flood yours too. I know I'm yours cause your mind's tent. To make me wanna shake for you. Impressive how your kind designed computers to reach all its goals. By the way, hope you don't mind.
That was just a bit more of Mother Nature by LOL9. Emmeline Friedman is a psychologist and social theorist, author of Internet Addiction, A Critical Psychology of Users. John Hawken interviews her now on cryptocurrencies and how to understand the politics of these digital technologies. Jan, will KBOO accept bitcoins as part of our fundraising?
Welcome to KBOO, Emmeline Friedman.
Thanks for having me back here.
You've been on the Old Mole before to talk about the internet and digital technologies, including possibilities for reclaiming the internet as a public good or commons. So thank you for coming onto the show again today to discuss cryptocurrencies, that shadowy world that is mystifying to many, even as it has gained ground in the world of finance and become the target of increased calls for federal regulation. So let's start with a basic definition of cryptocurrencies. How do you define the basic principles or operating functions that classify a crypto or digital currency?
Sure. So the simplest definition of a cryptocurrency would just be a virtual currency used by members of a digital social network. And they can be used in numerous ways. So they represent an ownership stake of some digital asset. And they're often used to keep records and also to transact between members of the network.
So there's a whole side of this that has to do with its history and the banking crisis and the rise of Bitcoin after the 08-09 banking crisis, the Wild West of currencies, and has generated critiques from the left. I'd like to take up before your analysis of some of its promising possibilities. And as we all know, an intrinsic feature of capitalism is the banking and credit system. And there are those who argue that this is a newest symptom of capitalist crisis and its pathologies, the circulation of money and commodities through monetary systems that are removed from real human needs, and that digital currencies are even more removed from real human needs than the conventional monetary system that governs the world of banks and finance. So how would you respond to that critique?
Well, I think it is without a doubt the case that the first cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, emerged in response to the banking crisis of 08-09, as you say, and it was created to be a peer-to-peer cash system, basically an experiment in whether money as a form of social agreement could be made trustworthy by computation and by cryptography rather than by what is known in the cryptocurrency world as by government fiat, right? Because the government says it is and because you can use it to pay taxes. However, the question of whether or not cryptocurrencies are removed from, would you say, the actual world?
Yeah, the world of human need. And well, maybe we can return to that in a bit in terms of how you see the relationship between social needs and this world of cryptocurrencies. But I think there is also the question that many in the left take up around how circulation of commodities are converted into money and back into commodities. In his labor theory of value, Karl Marx describes capitalism as a system that generates profits for capitalists through extraction of surplus value from labor power. The circulation of money into commodities, including labor as a commodity and back into money, disguises the human relationships and exploitation built into the capitalist system itself. So from this theoretical perspective, do cryptocurrencies conceal relations of exploitation?
You know, Jan, I think this is where I diverge from that critique of cryptocurrencies, because as someone involved in distributed ledger technologies myself, what I see there is less an effort, and this is very much tethered to the mainstream critique of crypto as well, is that people assume that the idea is to recreate money itself. Like it's to replace an abstract media of exchange. And that's not necessarily the case. That's not necessarily what people who create cryptocurrencies are trying to do with their technologies. In fact, they're often trying to distribute a stake in a project or to distribute some other form of social responsibility and stake in their network, irrespective of what the aim of using it is. So, for example, you could have a cryptocurrency that denotes a voting right in a project that is aimed to collectivize effort around, say, it's doing a cleanup effort in an area or something like that. So, in addition to being a representation of abstract value, people also use cryptocurrencies to denote stake and to denote responsibility. And so in that way, it actually has the possibility of amplifying social relations and making clear what it is that people care about and the way that they are collectivizing effort amongst themselves.
You're saying in that sense, defetishizing commodity production by exposing relations of production. Is this related to the blockchain technology? And you mentioned the distributed ledgers. Can you explain that a little bit? Those technologies that are the basis of, I guess, both these worlds of in kind of the Wild West of investments and also these other uses you're describing.
Gladly. Yeah. So what the public often hears about when they hear about cryptocurrency is these digital commodities, these coins that are created as a result of some sort of work in the network. So for example, a Bitcoin goes into circulation whenever someone's computer runs a complex computation that clears a transaction from one person to another. So essentially, like a Bitcoin emerges as a form of payment for, you know, someone's computer acting as a clearinghouse in the way that a bank typically would.
And there are hundreds of them now, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, cryptocurrencies?
Yeah.
There are thousands.
Oh.
There are nearly 10,000 cryptocurrencies.
So lots and lots.
Yeah, and this is not because people are trying to rival the function of Bitcoin as a transaction clearinghouse. This is because people are taking advantage of the underlying technology that has been developing since 2008. And this underlying technology is known as distributed ledger technology. So
is that related to the blockchain?
Exactly. Concept. So whether it's
can
a blockchain.
Can you describe that for our radio listeners? We don't have a whiteboard, but you can do a diagram. So let's sketch that out for us.
I think I can simplify. So the way that coins and transactions and other things, like I mentioned, voting is recorded is on a blockchain. So what a blockchain does is it replicates a copy of every transaction that happens on a network. It's basically like a record of events that everyone who's a member of the network stores on their own computer. And that's what's called being a full node. So essentially on a blockchain, the reason why it is trustworthy and the reason why you don't need a central intermediary like a bank or like a database like Facebook's data centers, for example, is because everyone who participates stores a copy of what happens. And there have been other innovations in how to do this, but basically it's called distributed ledger technology because a ledger that records what the social network is doing is held by all of its members. And this is the key piece of decentralizing the power of the record holder that is really piquing the interest of, you know, social groups that are also seeking to distribute power differently from how it's distributed in, for example, capitalist firms.
So before we continue with that aspect of its use value, there are, of course, many environmental issues and alarm over just the massive amount of hard drive space that these ledgers consume that are quite staggering in the aggregate. Can you say anything about that aspect of the technology?
Absolutely. So you can hear right in the definition I gave, you know, the fact that everyone holds a copy of everything that happens in the network uses a massive amount of computation and storage and therefore energy and electricity, right? So this is indeed a serious issue facing the blockchain world. But as I alluded to, there are other innovations that are seeking to sort of create the same use value, like create a trustworthy distributed ledger, even if it doesn't necessarily do the replication of computation that uses so much energy.
So you're not concerned about that, the environmental aspect of the technologies? I mean, you think they can be addressed without greenwashing?
Well, I happen to, you know, full disclosure, I happen to work on a project called Holochain that I was immediately attracted to in 2017 because I was concerned with this energy problem. And Holochain is a different distributed ledger technology from blockchain that does not replicate all data on the network, but it, you know, it does a different sort of technical maneuver called gossip, where it creates enough redundancy in order to trust the ledger, but it doesn't replicate all of the data fully in the way that consumes so much energy. And my project is not the only one doing this. There are other efforts to address the energy use while also maintaining the trustworthiness that enables the ledger to be truly distributed.
So the jury's out on that point. One question I have for you relates to the social organization aspects of this, that it seems to me that it requires considerable sophistication to enter into this world, even at this level of the distributed ledgers, and that people are not provided much protection. There's no help desk. No, you know, when my bank account gets hacked, I can call my credit union and, you know, tell them what happened and, you know, and the funds get retrieved. There are help desks in this world that people are learning about and navigating, some through companies and some through things like the credit unions. From what I understand of entering into the digital world of currencies or ledgers, there is considerable exposure, vulnerability to being hacked, exploited at that level, at the user interface level. Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely the case. And, you know, part of the Wild West of crypto is that you don't get those assurances. But one thing that I do want to add is that I think that those are issues primarily facing people who enter into crypto networks as consumers, or basically as speculators, right? So if you want to simply buy Bitcoin because you think that it will rise in value, you have to interact with some sort of exchange that isn't regulated the way that, you know, the way that the stock exchange is or the way that typical banks are. However, if you enter in as a producer or as a participant, you could say, on the network, you know, as we mentioned, there are 10,000 currency projects and they don't all sort of focus on this speculative value element. A lot of them focus on, you know, creating buy-in for some sort of social project. And it could connect up with anything in the real world, basically. So it really depends why you are entering into a crypto network, you know, whether it's to speculate on a popular cryptocurrency is one thing, but if it is to, you know, be a participant in a digital cooperative form of organizing, that's quite another.
In closing, is there an example, either a real example or a conceptual or theoretical example to illustrate that potential for these technologies and perhaps what is more associated with the libertarian anarcho-syndicalist traditions of confronting and finding alternatives outside of the capitalist finance system?
Sure, absolutely. So I'll leave us with, you know, we addressed the energy issue of blockchains. So I will leave us with an example of a, you know, a cooperative microgrid company that is building their cooperative on Holochain. And this is a company, you know, it started in, I believe, Australia, and it's called Red Grid. And the idea is that they are using they're using the cryptocurrency space to provide micro funding for solar panels. And they also intend to use distributed ledgers to track the use of these solar panels and to sort of keep track of how much energy there is and at which times for a community of participants. And holding this cryptocurrency that they're creating also gives one voting rights about, you know, the direction that the company takes. So as you can see, there are some elements of using fine-grained computation that would be required in a solar panel energy project in the first place. There are elements of using the cryptocurrency world to gain funding for a project without having to go through traditional channels. And there are also elements of holding a stock, which is that one has some sort of governance rights in the network.
In along the lines of a co-op model?
Exactly.
Well, this is hopefully demystifying, although there's, I think, a lot still to navigate, and the terrain ahead still is uncertain in terms of where these technologies go and how they intersect with the world of finance and banking. That the left, since Marx particularly, has been generated critiques and often alternatives such as social banks or public banks. So we'll have to bring you on the show again and help us follow this as it unfolds further. This is Jan Hawken talking today with Emmeline Friedman about cryptocurrencies and their potential for the left.
Thanks again for having me.
Thank you, Jan and Emmeline. I'm not sure we got an answer about whether KBOO can accept cryptocurrencies, but we are in fundraising mode. However you're able to help out will be much appreciated. The easiest way is to go to kboo.fm/give. Alternatively, text KBOO to 44321 or mail a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. On last week's Old Mole, Bill Resnick and Al Weinrub contrasted two visions of our energy future, one of them highly centralized and corporate, the other more reliable, less expensive, and community-based. In the second part of their interview, they focus on how our movements could actually achieve the desirable alternative. Bill?
Hi, Al Weinrub. Welcome again to KBOO here in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you, Bill.
Al Weinrub started out as a physicist early on, recognized the dangers of global warming, then left a academic career to become a community organizer, not just warning us about global warming, but building movements that could lead to the reconstruction necessary to save us from unimaginable catastrophe on an uninhabitable planet. To that aim, he co-founded the local Clean Energy Alliance of the Bay Area, also wrote the classic book Community Power, Decentralized Renewable Energy in California, and co-edited the book Energy Democracy. So Al, this is the second and last part of our interview. In part one last week, we compared two contesting plans for stopping climate cataclysm. We demonstrated that the corporate plan, with its huge remote nuclear plants and sun and wind farms connected to the cities by a fantastically expensive continent-spanning supergrid, would hardly get off the ground in the time available. In contrast, the left plan, the alternative to the corporate plan, it's already operating in some cities around the globe. That alternative, a decentralized network of community energy agencies building out sun and wind installations, small and big, all near the point of use, employing proven off-the-shelf technology. The decentralized network, it's clearly to be far more reliable, far less expensive, and far faster to build out than the corporate disaster in the making. This week, we'll be discussing the troubles that community energy agencies have in building out their systems. Financial problems, ideological problems, problems because U.S. corporations dominate our economy and state, and among those corporations are the investor-owned utilities trying to destroy the community energy agencies. Then there's troubles of their own making that lead them to buying power from faraway producers rather than building out the local system. And finally, there are problems that magnify the other problems. That is the problem that magnifies the other problems. There's little time remaining. Maybe 10 years, maybe 15, say the climate scientists who vastly reduce greenhouse gas emissions and stop global warming. Later today, we'll pivot from problems and troubles to discuss what can and must be done to overcome those problems and build out the decentralized, democratized local sun and wind energy system in the little time left. So, Al, tell us about the troubles and barriers that community energy agencies face.
Bill, what you say is right, is that remote energy is always touted as being low cost. And that's always been a fiction. And it comes from the fact that when the utilities are talking, they're always talking cost, but they're never talking benefit, right? Because whatever the cost is, they're the ones that are reaping the benefits. But when we shift our orientation to looking at the community and what the community needs, we think a lot more in terms of cost-benefit relationship. So it's not about cost. It's not primarily about cost. It's what you get for those costs. And the question of benefits comes in. Now, of course, the utilities don't care about community benefits. They only care about their own bottom line. So when they say it's cheaper out in the desert to get electricity, I mean, what they're not mentioning is that, by the way, that means we build these transmission lines that are needed to carry that electricity. And in terms of the model that most private utilities use, like especially the monopoly utilities in California, which I'm familiar with, but it's a general notion, is that their business model, their profit model is that they get a fixed return, a guaranteed return on infrastructure investments. That's where they make their money. So the more they build in terms of infrastructure, the more profit they make. And the less they build, that's the extent to which it undermines their business model. And the utility industry understood that going back to, you know, basically 2013, almost 8-9 years ago, when they said, wait a minute, all this rooftop solar that people are building or trying to build, let's put it that way, it was sort of at the beginning of the growth, they said, people are providing electricity to themselves and their communities that doesn't require new transmission lines. That's going to be a problem because to the extent that that load grows, you know, that departing load, we'll call it departing load because it's load, it's like electricity that the utilities no longer have to provide because we're providing it on our own. To the extent that that happens, there's nothing to invest in. And so our whole profit model goes into the dumper, and it was called the utility death spiral, in fact. That's what they called it. And so they launched this big campaign, you know, to stop what we call rooftop solar or what's called solar self-generation or by other people behind the meter solar, the notion that people can put solar panels up on their own properties, schools, community centers, churches, you name it, right? It's a way of basically people deciding that they could shield themselves from the abuses of utilities, you know, putting their own power on in their own buildings. So this is a piece that they don't talk about when they say electricity is cheaper, because they're not talking about the transmission costs that we all pay. In California, 2/3 of our bill is on the transmission side. And distribution side, it's not for the electricity itself.
Yeah, besides that, of course, in the benefit side, it's far more reliable. They're up and down, the pylons are vulnerable. And in the cities, if a storm, if you get a big storm and things blow down, the repair crews are out there in the afternoon. When you get a pylon on the top of a mountain, it can take months before you get electricity. It's sort of baloney, their claim that they're in fact more reliable. They obviously aren't, in fact. The grids also have caused fires. They're constantly being shut down when the wind is blowing and there's a possibility even of a fire. But of course, the utilities don't mention the many, many benefits of local energy, including jobs and keeping money in the community and getting jobs for people who are in poor communities who desperately need them now at decent rates of pay.
What you're pointing to, Bill, is the fact that, you know, the cost-benefit calculation has been changing, and it's been changing rapidly. So we could always point to the fact that local renewable development of all kinds of resources, including energy efficiency and battery storage and whatnot, always had huge benefits to our local communities economically and environmentally and even our ability to try to address social injustices. But what's happened is because of the changing climate and the vulnerability of the centralized energy model, we now have like a whole new factors coming in, which is that these large transmission lines create huge risk because they can spark fires or when they go down, people are left without power, but also risk because the utilities are shutting down power in a preemptive strike against wildfires and other things. So now this cost-benefit analysis has changed to the point where the resilience value of local energy development and deployment is hugely larger than it was before. And on the other hand, the liabilities of the centralized energy model is already escalating rates in order to be able to deal with the damages of fires and other problems, as well as repair the transmission system and everything else. So yes, that whole balance between cost-benefit is shifting dramatically.
That was Al Weinrub. We just discussed today the problems community energy faces, including corporate domination of the economy and state, and hostility and suppression by the investor-owned utilities. And unfortunately, sometimes those same utilities, there's parts of their leadership at the mid-level, management levels, is hired by the boards of the community energy agencies who get taken in by the supposed expertise of those leaders. So let's switch gears some. Despite all the problems they face, still people are struggling and decentralized energy production is still growing. What's your sense of how the decentralized confederated system could prevail and at some point its movements gain sufficient political power to direct the great mobilization of all our resources in cooperation across the globe that will be necessary? Do you see any road to gaining power, to organizing the maybe 25 other substantial greenhouse gas emitting countries in a planet-wide cooperative effort? What's your sense? Are there grounds for hope?
Well, as we've been talking, you know, this transition to renewable energy is really not a technical transition. We have the technologies. It's really a struggle for power, for political and economic power. And, you know we've had a climate movement developing over many years, at least in the U.S., you know, to sort of counteract the fossil fuel industry and call for a transition to renewable energy. But, you know, one of the shortcomings of that movement is that it hasn't talked about what the solution space has to look like. And we've been talking about how the decentralized energy model is the direction, you know, that we have to go. And there has been in this country building over time, over the last half dozen years or so, movement that's really advocating for more decentralized models of renewable energy. And it's important to connect that movement also with the whole racial reckoning that's going on in this country. It's really important because the folks that are in the leadership of the decentralized energy movement, if you want to call it that, we actually call it the movement for energy democracy. It's a movement to democratize energy resources. In other words, for communities and people, you know, to have more control and ownership of energy resources and decision-making power, you know. So this is where the question of the struggle for power really comes up. So this notion that we should have more decentralized energy systems is really part of a movement to democratize energy. And that movement has been growing over the last many years as there's been a shift in thinking about how the question of energy is really a question of democracy. And then that brings to the fore immediately different political forces and who's in motion. And it's not by accident that the folks that are in the leadership of the energy democracy movement are basically people of color, low-income people, largely women who've been in the leadership of this movement, because you can't separate the questions of democracy from racial justice, and you can't separate environmental justice, which has been a growing movement in this country, from questions of energy justice. It's all the same thing. So essentially what's been happening is that the contours of the movement have been changing, where a movement that was more like what we call carbon fundamentalist, you know, we got to reduce carbon and move to, you know, renewable forms of energy, is moving much more toward a movement for climate justice, which is really a movement for democracy and a movement against injustices. And so people of color are really in the leadership of that movement. And that's a very hopeful sign, because as we know in this country, that communities of color have often been in the forefront of movements that are important for the survival and the health of all of us. So I'm quite hopeful that, you know, that movement will grow.
Al, it seems to me that the idea of local energy and its resilience really is growing. I have one last thing I want to bring up with you. My sense is that the corporate establishment is really well secure in the United States right now. And we could build up the system so that people understand us, that there's a contender for managing and we're built for creating energy that we need and managing the system, that it doesn't have to be done by the IOUs. We can certainly, I think, create knowledge of that alternative. It seems to me that it's, of course, the time problem. My sense is that within the next, the climate scientists say it, it's not my sense, I'm repeating them, we have less than 10 years, in fact, to make vast reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, or else feedback loops are likely to get generated, which on their own, without any more human emissions of greenhouse gases, that the concentrations will continue to go up, including by this, the decay of all of the vegetable matter that's in the tundras and in the in areas called swamps, and once droughts come. There's so many ways that greenhouse gas emissions could greatly increase just from natural sources. So if we have 10 years, we're pretty certain that the storms are going to get greater, the damage is going to be greater, the oceans will keep rising, the coastal cities, Miami and parts of Louisiana and California could be underwater, parts of New York City. They're talking about building this humongous, enormous, expensive system of dikes and barriers. There's going to be enormous amount of damage. There's going to be life loss. Infrastructure, particularly in rural areas, is going to be destroyed. People are going to wake up. it seems to me they're going to realize that the corporate people have not much interest, nor are they acting on the actual possibilities of doing stopping climate change by having a decentralized energy system that would also have as one of its major goals energy conservation and use reduction, which is so possible in the United States. We waste so much energy. It would be much cheaper to build up. It would take very, very small sums in comparison to what the losses would be to build very reliable and efficient energy systems in the local areas. So Al, what do you think? At some point, it seems to me the people are going to wake up and our alternative will begin looking much more attractive. Anyway, that's my hope. Why don't you comment on it?
Yes, well, the issue about what will happen in the future as climate conditions accentuate and accelerate and create more and more havoc and chaos, you know, it depends on the kind of movement and the kind of political organizing that we do. I just want to make a couple of comments. I mean, one is there's clearly a climate emergency, but there was a climate emergency in 1992, you know, when people started to understand what's going on. And there's been 30 years of all this talk about changing to renewable and whatnot that basically it seemed very abstract to most of the population. And so the fact that there's a climate emergency is not really anything new. And it's a very dangerous concept in a certain way, because for most people, what a climate emergency means is that we have to reduce carbon reductions. And what that means is that we really forget about questions of decentralized energy and equity and what's in the benefit of most of the people of the country. And so basically, a lot of the climate emergency forces are actually folks whose program represents a lot of white privilege and a lot of sort of attitudes of, well, we'll deal with racism later, and we're dealing with the climate right now. So the climate emergency kind of framing to the question, as compared to a climate justice framing, is actually not a positive force in my mind. Clearly, there is an emergency, but the question is how you deal with it is what's important. And if you don't deal with it in a way that provides for justice and that addresses injustices, it means that politically it's not really going to happen. You're not going to build the kind of political strength you need to be able to move in a positive direction. So if people are holding on to sort of essentially a white privilege approach to dealing with the climate, then they will fail and we will all fail with it. This is why I spoke before about the leadership of people of color and the environmental justice community and energy democracy as setting a direction. The fact that people rise up does not always result in good conditions. You know, people often have been seen to rise up in a very politically reactionary way. In fact, this is what the whole Trump presidency has shown, is that right-wing fascist forces create chaos, and out of chaos they promise order and they promise dictatorship as a way of solving problems. So the fact that conditions will get worse and people will rise up doesn't mean anything positive unless we have a model and a movement that can point to a direction that really addresses questions of justice more than questions of greenhouse gas reductions, frankly, because that's what we've seen for the last 30 years, is that, you know, a movement that's been focused just on a technological transition without looking at the real political power questions has fallen short. So we need to move in a direction that recognizes that the climate emergency creates opportunities to empower our communities to take control of resources. That is the only way that we're going to really survive on the planet. And, you know, the corporate infrastructure and those powers that be will always use a climate emergency in order to try to cement their control and their solution of the problem. I mean, just imagine giving the Trump administration emergency powers to deal with the climate situation and what that could have meant.
Yeah, I agree with how the neo-fascist right operates by sowing chaos with their street wing,
while their political wing is running on a platform of law and order and a return to national greatness, they present an enormous threat to us and the planet and to the possibilities of a decent society. And it has to be met, and the climate action movements have to be involved in undermining their power and reaching out to the people that they're reaching. As to the climate movement, it must be more than inclusive of everybody. It has to be more than inclusive. It has to include everybody in this country and internationally. All of our fates are intertwined. We need international cooperation. And to take power from the powerful, the all-powerful, the corporate set, the bankers and financiers, and all of their servants, that requires accepting and reaching out to every social sector in this country with an explicit program as we are reconstructing the economy, and particularly the energy system, which lies at the center of any modern economy. The benefits of the reconstruction have to flow first to those who have lived on the edge economically and humiliated and punished socially. Climate justice and economic justice are indispensable for building the forces to stop global roasting. Al Weinreb, it's been great talking to you. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks very much.
And that's our program for today. Thanks to Old Moles, Luisa Martinez, Bill Resnick, and Jan Hocken for their contributions, to our guests, Al Weinreb and Emmeline Friedman, and to Old Moles, Denise Morris and John Nelson for their editing help. Thanks, too, to the staff at KABU for their guidance and responsiveness in difficult circumstances. 80% of the funds the station relies on come from listeners like you, but not all listeners donate or are even in a position to donate. If you're able, please support this important community resource. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KABU to 44321 or send a check to KABU at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And remember that 10 donors at whatever level you can will receive your choice of a Betty Lee print on behalf of Betty and the Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll go out with more music from Lowell 9. Catch you next Monday morning. Stay safe and stay active. Faster, get that oil, put your micro. Plastics in my soil, feel so great. One thing you overpopulate, extra closer.